Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, one-on-one. Dr. Anthony Fauci discusses the latest on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause and how to reopen public spaces. Then, charging ahead, we break down the roadblocks to the Biden administration's push for electric vehicles. Plus, the road ahead, a potential lifeline of federal funding for health care and infrastructure is within reach for tribal lands disproportionately affected by the pandemic.
This is a pretty monumentous step forward. You know, this is one of the biggest single investments that the federal government has ever made in history directly to indigenous people.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart address the meaning of the Chauvin verdict, investigations into the Capitol riot, and the president's ambitious climate goals. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A CDC panel is urging an end to the pause on using Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine. The group says the shots should include a warning about rare blood clots. It found 15 cases, three of them fatal, out of nearly 8 million vaccinations. The CDC usually follows the committee's recommendations. Meanwhile, the agency's director warned of vaccination gaps in parts of the country. She also encouraged pregnant women to be immunized.
No safety concerns were observed for people vaccinated in the third trimester or safety concerns for their babies. As such, CDC recommends that pregnant people receive the COVID-19 vaccine.
We'll talk to infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci after the news summary. An explosion of COVID infections in India forced urgent action today. Officials reported nearly 333,000 new cases in just 24 hours and more than 2,200 deaths. The government shipped oxygen tanks on special express trains as hospitals appealed for help. Some threatened to halt new admissions. President Biden's climate summit ended today with a focus on giving up fossil fuels. The virtual session included world leaders, as well as billionaires Bill Gates and Michael Bloomberg and others. They talked of major spending on innovation and renewable energy. Mr. Biden cast it as a way to generate jobs.
Today's final session is not about the threat of climate change poses. It's about the opportunity that addressing climate change provides. People working in the fields that we haven't even conceived of yet, on farms and on factories and in laboratories and universities, with things we haven't even thought of so far.
Summit nations will meet again for formal negotiations in November. California Governor Gavin Newsom says that he will halt all new permits for oil and gas fracking in 2024. The process involves hydraulic fracturing of underground rock, and environmental groups oppose it. Newsom also ordered regulators today to plan for ending all oil production in California by 2045. Some 130 migrants bound for Europe are feared dead after capsizing off Libya. It happened Wednesday in the Mediterranean Sea, northeast of Tripoli, the Libyan capital city. A French rescue ship found an overturned rubber boat on Thursday. Rescue groups say that 350 migrants have drowned off Libya since the year began. In Jerusalem, Israeli police arrested 44 people overnight in clashes with Palestinians and Jewish extremists. Security forces fired stun grenades and water cannon at crowds protesting restrictions on their gathering during Ramadan. Nearby, far-right Jewish nationalists fought with police at an anti-Arab rally. Russian dissident Alexei Navalny is ending a 24-day hunger strike in prison. In an online post today, he said that he has now received medical care from independent doctors, as he had demanded. His own doctors had warned that his health was failing, and they urged him to stop the hunger strike. Back in this country, a Pentagon panel recommended that independent authorities take over decisions about prosecuting troops for sexual assault. commanders have always made those decisions, and the military has opposed any change. A spokesman says that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin will sound out service leaders on the proposals.
He wants the services to have a chance to look at them and give him his feedback. He obviously will be taking all those inputs seriously as he weighs next steps.
Reports of sexual assaults have risen steadily since 2006. President Biden has made plans for his first overseas trip since taking office. The White House says he will attend the Group of Seven summit in England in June. From there, he will go to Brussels to meet with leaders of the European Union and NATO. And on Wall Street today, stocks made up some lost ground. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 227 points to close at 34,043. The NASDAQ rose 198 points. The S&P 500 added 45. Still to come on the NewsHour, Dr. Anthony Fauci discusses the latest on the vaccination effort, the Biden administration's push toward electric vehicles, a major federal investment in tribal lands hopes to counteract long-standing inequities, and how soccer fans took down plans for a super-secret new league, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine appears to be on the verge of being given out once again. That is after a CDC advisory panel recommended to do so and provide a warning. Before the panel's recommendation, I spoke today with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He's also the chief medical advisor to President Biden. And we should note that Johnson & Johnson is a funder of the NewsHour. Dr. Fauci, thank you very much for joining us. You and I are recording this interview before we know what the CDC is going to say today about whether to reauthorize the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But whatever their decision is, how much of a setback to the overall effort to get vaccine into as many arms as possible has this pause been?
I don't think it has really been significant, Judy, particularly since if they make the decision to go back out there and get this vaccine back in play, I think you're going to see people who wanting to get this particular vaccine will be lining up to get it. I think that the pause, although for a period of time there, some people felt that maybe that's going to diminish the confidence in the vaccine, I think on the other hand, it might have the opposite effect, that given the fact that this is such a rare event, the fact that this was paused indicates how seriously we take safety when we're dealing with vaccines. So this should really encourage people and fortify the concept that safety is of critical importance.
It now looks as if the average daily number of people getting vaccinations is plateauing. And given that, my question is, what are we at? 140 million Americans have at least one dose of a vaccine. What does that say about how hard it's going to be to get everybody else who you want to have the vaccine? I mean, there have been a lot of pleas made to Americans to have the vaccine, but there are clearly many who are hesitant.
Yes, and that's what we're trying to address, Judy. I mean, there are people who clearly are in the wait-and-see atmosphere, but when you have 140-plus million people who have received at least one dose, I think the wait and see has gotten to the point where there's a very efficacious a vaccine that in the real world is really doing very, very well in protecting people. The data that we are getting in follow-up indicate that the vaccines are at least as effective and maybe even more effective than what we saw with the clinical trial results. And we have situations now, you know, we've established a COVID-19 community core to get trusted messengers in the community, be they professional athletes, be they entertainers, be they members of the clergy, to go out and to explain to people why it's so important for their own safety, for that of their family, and really for the community in general to get vaccinated. So we realize that we have to give an extra push as we get to that point where you have less and less of a proportion that's unvaccinated. It's going to be more difficult to get people, but I think we're up for that challenge. And I think when the American people listen to the data of why it's so important to get vaccinated, I think you're going to see people get vaccinated at a greater rate than most people are expecting at this point.
But as I'm sure you know, many people are still telling, at least when they're asked, some of them are saying, I just don't want the vaccine. How hard, how far should the government be pushing with the cooperation of the private sector to get people to get this vaccine if they're resistant?
Well, I think we have to keep trying to reach out and explain to people why it's so important. You know, there are a couple of aspects to it. And one of the things that we try to get across to people that they may not appreciate at first glance, and that is, if you have a younger person who will say correctly and understandably that if you are young and healthy, the chances of you getting a serious outcome are very low. That is a fact and true. However, there are now seeing a lot more young people getting infected, particularly with this variant, the 117 from the UK, which transmits clearly more efficiently than the original virus. There's no doubt about that, that you have a danger of getting infected, and you also have a danger of getting a serious consequence. The other thing that we want to impress upon people is that even if you don't get any symptoms and you get infected, it doesn't end there, Judy. Ultimately, you may be responsible for someone getting seriously ill. You don't want to be part of the dynamics of the outbreak. You want to be part of the solution.
You do raise something in mentioning the variants that I want to ask you, because it wasn't that long ago we were told this was a race, in effect, between the vaccine and the variant. Who's winning?
You know, right now, you know, that is a good question. I think we really are at a turning point right now, and we're really at that point where we're just about seeing the crossing over, because if you look at the curves, we're getting more and more people vaccinated. We're getting about 3 million people per day, and yet the cases are at that high level of about 60,000 per day on a 7-day average. I believe as we get more and more people vaccinated, you're going to start seeing a crossing of those curves, where you're going to start seeing the number of cases coming down as the vaccine total number goes up. That's exactly what we saw in Israel.
So we could be on the cusp of good news, but I have to ask you, how concerned are you about these so-called breakthrough infections, infections showing up in people who have had 2 vaccinations?
Yeah, you know, a great point to bring up, Judy. The CDC just reported on a few thousand of these. That sounds like a lot, but when you put it next to the denominator, the breakthrough infections are a fraction of a fraction of the people who've gotten vaccinated. So although you don't like to see any breakthroughs, when you have a few thousand against the millions and millions of people who've been vaccinated, it is a very, very rare event to have a breakthrough for someone who has been vaccinated.
I do have a question about the United States and the rest of the world. We know that the U.S. is doing well, as you've been describing overall. We're seeing a drop in cases, and yet the rest of the world, most of it not nearly as fortunate. We're seeing these horrible numbers in India, people running out of oxygen, hospitals overwhelmed. Next door, neighbor Canada, only 2.9%, or rather 2.6%, I saw today, of Canadians have been vaccinated. Worldwide, the number is something like 2.9%. Is it time now for the United States to do more to help the rest of the world?
You know, Judy, we will be doing that. You know, a number of things are ongoing right now. You know, we have rejoined COVAX. We've pledged or given $4 billion to that. We are in a situation where it's very clear when we get our people vaccinated. We're right now in a situation where we really want to make sure that we have our people vaccinated. But if the surplus doses become available, which they very likely will, that clearly that's on the table to share that with individuals. The other things that we're doing is that we want to be part of the situation when we will be helping countries to be able to produce the vaccine themselves. And that's something that we're right now talking to them about, the possibility. There are a lot of people that want to see that rather than just giving doses to a company, to a country, to allow the country to be able to make doses themselves, working with the pharmaceutical companies to see if they can work out some sort of an arrangement where that will be allowed. And as long as there is viral dynamics and viral spread in countries, particularly if it's rather profound spread, you can't be completely safe.
For people who are vaccinated, what is safe for them to do? People want to know, can I go to a restaurant indoors? Can I go to the movie theater? Is it safe to get on an airplane? What is safe and what isn't? Should people wear a mask outdoors? I mean, what's your advice?
The CDC is going to be coming out with official guidelines. You know, they already said about in the home setting, if you're vaccinated, even you, if you're with unvaccinated people, you can take the mask off. You could have physical contact. The one thing people need to realize that being vaccinated, the risk of everything you do is considerably less than if you were not vaccinated. So going outside, you're going to be hearing a reevaluation of whether you're going to have to wear a mask outside. That's being considered literally in real time now by the CDC. They've already said that travel is much, much safer when you have vaccination, when you've been vaccinated. The real critical issue is it's also dependent upon the level of infection in the community. So if the level of infection in the community is very low and you don't have new variants going on, there are so many more things that a person who is vaccinated can do even without a mask. And you're going to be seeing as the time goes by, hopefully much sooner rather than later, when the CDC will be coming out with guidances that will be much less restrictive with regard to what people can do when they are vaccinated.
So this is the guidance as of today, April 23rd, 2021. Dr. Anthony Fauci, thank you as always. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Judy. Good to be with you.
As part of his administration's broader climate change strategy, President Biden has made investing in electric vehicles a major focus of his $2 trillion jobs and infrastructure proposal. And this week, he has promoted the importance of technological innovation at a climate summit. But as William Brangham reports, there are still many barriers to those vehicles becoming widespread. Our story is part of an international journalism effort called Covering Climate Now.
There's a reason a lot of environmentalists focus on the future of electric cars, because today's cars emit a lot of planet-warming gases. As a category, transportation is the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., even higher than electricity. And within transportation, light-duty vehicles, like cars and trucks, are the largest source of those emissions. So now, a president who adores his dad's gas-guzzling Corvette...
I didn't get a chance to flash it in the second. I was afraid I'd go through those guys.
...wants to see electric cars rule the road. But getting electric vehicles, or EVs for short, into widespread use has some obstacles. First among them, according to environmental economist Joshua Lin, is consumer demand.
So right now, electric cars account for about 2 or 3% of the market. Meaning 2 or 3% of new vehicles sold each year are electric cars.
Tiny, tiny fraction.
So it's tiny. It's been growing. You know, it was at zero 10 years ago.
According to a Consumer Reports survey, Americans cite a few reasons for their reluctance. Worries about how far EVs can travel on one battery charge. Concern over the higher upfront cost of EVs, though studies show consumers save even more money over time because they never buy gas. And concern over having enough places to charge an EV's battery.
Many consumers are just not familiar with the technology and haven't ridden in one, don't know anybody who has, and also haven't really thought through how much their life changed if they had an electric car.
Thought I'd show the car a little bit.
Ronald Kaltenbaugh is something of an EV evangelist. He's president of a Washington, D.C. group that promotes them. He told me about the first time he test drove a Tesla Model S, a car famous for its lightning-quick acceleration and $70,000 price tag.
The sales guy, its co-pilot, and we're at a stoplight, and he says, go ahead and gun it off the line. And the only thing I can compare it to is if you're on a roller coaster that accelerates really fast, it's kind of like that.
I think that's one of the great misconceptions is people think you're going to get an electric car. It's only going to go as fast as a golf cart. It's only going to go 5 miles before it needs to get plugged in. And then it's going to take 3 days to charge up the battery like an old cell phone.
That is a big misconception. Once you get people to in the car driving it or seeing it, then they're like, oh my gosh.
Mr. President, we're at the final assembly stop.
To help the rest of the country feel that same enthusiasm, President Biden's American Jobs Plan includes a heavy emphasis on electric vehicles. It calls for $174 billion of investment, including rebates for people who purchase EVs, money for research into better battery technology, encouraging the government's vast fleet of cars and buses to become electric, and money to build 500,000 public charging stations across the country for anyone to use.
We're going to provide tax incentives and point-of-sale rebates to help all American families afford clean vehicles of the future.
Some states, like California, have already established mandates to require that a certain percentage of vehicles sold in the state emit zero pollution. And now 12 governors, all Democrats, have sent a letter to the Biden administration urging it to, quote, ensure that all new passenger cars and light-duty trucks sold are zero emission no later than 2035.
Let's go, America.
Adding to this momentum, several big automakers have announced they're already moving away from gas power.
Did you know that Norway sells way more electric cars per capita than the U.S.? Norway.
General Motors, one of the biggest automakers in the world, said in just 4 years it will have over 30 electric models for sale and that it wants to phase out tailpipe emissions totally for cars, trucks, and SUVs by 2035. Dane Parker is the company's chief sustainability officer.
Now, the current data that we have says more than 80% of charging happens at home. And there's a large number of current consumers who are able to charge at home. And for them, this will be seamless because the range of these electric vehicles is going to be sufficient for the vast majority of use cases.
But even as automakers introduce more electric vehicles, one estimate shows that even by 2050, when electrics could be a majority of new car sales, most cars on the road will still be burning gas.
And we end up with a Chevy Bolt.
For the true believers like Ron Kaltenbaugh, who's driven his electric car hundreds of miles to Vermont and to Detroit, he says there are so many reasons to go electric that they ought to appeal to everyone.
You can be an early adopter and like tech. You can be a car enthusiast and like fast cars. You can be an environmentalist and be concerned about climate change. You can be a foreign policy, national security person and worry about, you know, nasty governments and oil funding terrorism. Anybody in the political spectrum, you can find a reason why they should love EVs and want to move to them as quick as possible.
President Biden's infrastructure plan still has another main hurdle, passage by a divided Congress. Until that happens, the president's aspirations for a more electric future are still on hold. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
Last month, Congress approved a record amount of money for Native American tribes in the American Rescue Plan. Today, First Lady Jill Biden spent the second of 2 days in Indian Country, meeting with Navajo officials and hearing about their needs after a devastating COVID-19 outbreak on the Navajo Nation last year. Stephanie Tsai reports on what the potential future looks like for Indigenous Americans.
Judy, as we've been reporting throughout the pandemic, American Indians and Native Alaskans have been hit hard with a higher mortality rate than any other ethnic group in the United States. There are some positive signs now, a stretch of many days on the Navajo Nation where there has not been a single COVID-related death. More than half the residents are now vaccinated. Now tribal communities look forward to an infusion of resources. The COVID stimulus bill allocates $31 billion to serve them and includes $20 billion that goes directly to tribal governments, $6 billion to bolster health systems, and more than $1 billion for housing. To talk about why this money is needed, we're joined by Nick Tilson from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. He is the founder and CEO of NDN Collective and an activist for tribal rights over lands. Nick Tilson, welcome back to the NewsHour. It's good to have you. You have often talked about indigenous power. How much does this funding mean to you and other Native leaders, especially after this year of tremendous loss?
This is a pretty monumentous step forward. You know, this is one of the biggest single investments that the federal government has ever made in history directly to indigenous people. And so it's a step in the right direction. And it's a realization that our advocacy and our efforts to be seen in society today and our struggles to be realized are things that need to be invested into. And so we're happy about the big investments going directly to tribes. We're happy about the investments to save Native languages. We're happy about the $1 billion investment into broadband, into some of really not just Native communities, but some of the most underinvested communities in the whole country. You know, you take like this opportunity of $1 billion being invested into Navajo, but you also have 65,000 people at Navajo who don't have power. Is broadband going to affect those people right out of the gate? And so I think that there's an opportunity here to address long-term systematic things like renewable energy in rural isolated communities that help, help work towards building of more resilient communities altogether.
The federal government has held billions of dollars in trust to support tribal communities, but critics have often said they still do not get enough support. Does this funding, Nick Tilson, help set up a future where Native communities might need to depend less on congressional appropriations?
There's really no amount of money that Congress can appropriate to fix its relationship with indigenous people. It actually has to change its relationship. Because of this, the federal government changed its relationship to Native people and started focusing on a free and prior informed consent. What ended up happening is the entire relationship with tribal nations and sovereign nations would change, because you would no longer see things like pipelines built through our lands, or extractive industries built through our lands, or decisions made about indigenous people without our consent. And so I hope that this investment begins to open a conversation about entering into a brand new policy era.
You talked about renewable energy and sustainability on Native lands. Like other communities in America, the oil, gas, and mining industries can mean jobs. And they also have those negative cultural and, in some cases, environmental impacts. What do you hear from other Native Americans about how they think about that issue?
The reality is the fossil fuel industry and the extractive industries have held indigenous communities economic hostage for the past 100 years and have violated violated federal policy and have eroded indigenous people's rights. And so, to be quite honest, the jobs that exist in fossil fuel industry is not the ones that we want in Indian country. And they have been few and far between and had very little to no economic impact on our communities. When you can envision thousands of indigenous people on the ground, working to steward their land and fight climate change and create a new economy that is actually one that is just and equitable. That's what excites me about the future.
You now have an insider. You have Deb Haaland, who is a Native American, the first to serve as a cabinet secretary. She is Secretary of the Interior, which oversees federal lands. So what are your hopes for her now that she has a seat at the big table?
I mean, our Indian country is rallying around Deb Haaland. She's definitely from Indian country, represents Indian country, and it's an opportunity to have a voice at the table. And so some of the messages that we're sending is, we need to start thinking about returning public lands, returning indigenous lands into indigenous hands. And that's what we talk a lot about in our land back movement. We want to see some movement on that. We also want to make sure that in our dealings with the Department of Interior, that we end up actually moving to this era of consent, And I think that Deb Haaland is a big advocate for that.
Nick Tilson joining us from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective, Nick.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
It is a week marked by a moment of reckoning for racial justice, by new calls to hold accountable those behind the January 6th insurrection, and by President Biden's ambitious push to combat climate change. To help make sense of it all, the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you. It's so good to see you on this Friday night.
Hey, Judy.
A lot to talk about. Let's start with the climate summit. David, President Biden laying out some really ambitious goals, saying the U.S. needs to deeply cut carbon emissions. Is it realistic? And is life going to have to change in this country to get there?
Well, it's noble and it's the right policy. I'm not sure how realistic it is. It's a policy that's it's going to introduce a lot of electric vehicles, as we just saw. We're going to have a new power grid. If all these things go through, will we really cut emissions by 50%? Well, at the height of COVID, when we were totally shut down, we cut emissions like 21%. So I'm not totally optimistic. I think the experts that I've read have said you got to do more. There has to be a price on carbon. You'd have to pretty much get rid of natural gas, evolve that out of existence, as well as oil-burning cars. So that's pretty radical stuff. But that doesn't make the perfect the enemy the good, or whatever the expression I'm searching for is. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. I think the really hard thing is China. China is just still burning coal plants. They're still producing more energy. John Kerry, our envoy, wants to keep our climate change policy toward China with China, independent of all of our other policies with China. As our relations get a lot rockier, as I imagine they will, I don't think that'll be possible. And so how will we create a global accord when we're really in some sort of cold war with China?
What do you think, Jonathan? Are these things that can really happen?
I think I'm with David here that I'm not sure whether these goals are, with the numbers that have been set, are actually attainable. What I take from the climate summit this week is, you know, President Biden, by holding this summit with the 42 nations, is sending a couple of signals. One, the United States is back in a leadership role in doing something about climate and doing something about climate change, that it wants to lead the global effort, a recognition that without the United States' participation, China and India will most definitely not participate in any action to do something about climate. And so if we're going to do anything, achieve any goal, we need to have the United States, China, India, and the world united in at least doing something. And I think that's what that summit was about this week.
Let me turn both of you to one of the, of course, big developments of the week, and that was the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial, accused in the murder of George Floyd. David, what do you take away from that? And what effect do you think, we talked about this some last week, but what effect do you think it could have on policing in this country and on relations between the races?
Well, you know, the most important news event that happened this week is something that didn't happen. We didn't get an acquittal. We didn't get civil unrest. We didn't get another occasion where people would lose faith in the system and really be disgusted by the system. That didn't happen. And so we can look with some satisfaction at a trial where I think most people agree justice was done. And we can look back on an episode in American life from the time of George Floyd's killing until the conviction, when race was on the table in a way it hasn't been, in my view, since mid-1960s. The problem, the disparities, the injustices have now become a topic of constant conversation and, in my view, a constant gradual truth-bearing. And this has been an awkward set of circumstances for a lot of people, a lot of hard conversations. But to me, it's in a rough year. It's been an overall positive, really positive development in American life.
And Jonathan, do you see these hard conversations leading to something meaningful?
I hope so, Judy. you know, that the conviction of Chauvin, what's interesting is that as wonderful as the conviction is, it is just a drop in the bucket in terms of solving the overall problem. Just moments literally before the verdict came down, there was the shooting in Columbus. And while we can, you know, quibble over the details of that shooting, the main thing that animates African Americans is this question: why is it that when law enforcement and African Americans interact, more often than not, African Americans are the ones who are injured, shot, or killed? And that is the overall question that needs to be answered. And I think these tough conversations that David is talking about that have been reignited over the last year, they must continue. This conversation cannot end. The verdict, the Chauvin guilty verdict on all three counts, cannot be the end of the conversation. It has to be the beginning or the continuation of a conversation that has been needed to be had in America for a very long time.
And David, do you see it continuing?
I do, and I think there's going to be progress on policing. I'm optimistic that the United States Senate, Tim Scott, the Republican, and Cory Booker, the Democrat, will reach a deal and that we will actually have a major police reform. I do think there has to be not just a change in procedures, there has to be a change in culture. Mm-hmm. The African Americans need to feel safe, and that means the police cannot have to be in the community, working with the community. And police officers have to feel safe, and that means the community has to be working with the police officers. And so it's the relationship between people in the community and people in the police force. It's community policing in its real form that is the solution, more beyond changing some procedures or some immunities.
And Jonathan, again, I know we talked about it last week, but is your sense that after this, we are going to see change?
I do think so, and I think the passage of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act would be a very good step. I am very optimistic about the bill's chances today, more so than I was a week ago today. The fact that Senators Cory Booker and Tim Scott and Congresswoman Karen Bass, who is the lead person in the House, are all talking about ways to get this bill done, including a conversation about qualified immunity, that is making it possible for people to sue police departments or police officers individually. That's a huge sticking point for Republicans. But the fact that Senator Scott put out a compromise that is, well, maybe not the police officers individually, but police departments, let's have that conversation. That was a very good signal that the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act actually stands a chance of passing and becoming law.
And David, there was a development this week around the attempt to come up with an independent commission to investigate what happened on January 6th, the insurrection at the Capitol. Speaker Pelosi has now made at least two sets of proposals, concessions, if you will, compromises to Republicans. So far, there's no agreement. How important is it that there be an independent investigation of what happened?
Yeah, this was a classic Republican moment. Nancy Pelosi said she made these two concessions, had sent a letter over to the Republicans, and the Republicans said, "We got a letter. Where's the letter? It was like we're pretending to talk. We're not really talking." You know, I think we should have a commission. It was a major event in American life, but B, and here I side a little with the Republicans who want to broaden the scope. I think we should not just investigate this as a one-day crime that happened. I think we have a problem, an ongoing problem, and a growing problem of violent extremism in this country, mostly on the right, mostly characterized by things like January 6th, but also a bit on the left. I think we need a commission that would say, what is the map of violent extremism in this country? How do these people communicate? Is there outside help? There are all sorts of fundamental questions that, if you broaden the scope of the thing, would help us deal with whatever future Charlottesville or Portland is coming down the road. And I think that is the core problem we're facing here.
Jonathan, do you think the scope should be broadened, as Republicans are saying they want?
Absolutely not. There is no comparison between the people, the insurrectionists who stormed the U.S. Capitol to subvert the will of the American people. There's no comparison between them and the loosely affiliated folks who are under the umbrella of so-called Antifa. What happened on January 6th needs to be investigated. The people who were involved in the planning, the people who just unleashed violence on the U.S. Capitol, but on American democracy. We need to know what happened, why it happened, and how we can prevent that from happening. And what happened on the 6th is part of a larger problem in the country of the rise of far-right extremism. And we should spend our time focused on that.
Well, somewhat in connection with all this, David, your column today in the New York Times, you carried, frankly, a sobering warning about what's happened to Republicans since President Trump left office. Spell out a little of what you're seeing and what your concern is.
Yeah, well, some of us had hopes that when Trump was not spewing hate from the Oval Office, life would calm down. In fact, the Republican Party has grown more radical in a specific way. It's become more catastrophically pessimistic. In one poll, people were asked, do you think politics is for policies or do you think it's for national survival? More than 50% of Trump voters think it's about national survival. Only 19% think government is about policies. In another survey question, people said, which of these two comments do you more agree with? It's a big, beautiful world filled with people who are mostly good, or our lives are threatened by criminals, terrorists, and illegal aliens, immigrants. 75% of Biden voters supported big, beautiful world. 66% of Trump voters supported our lives are threatened. And so here's a group of people who feel the very existence of the country they know is threatened, and they have to armor up. They have to get violent. They have to prepare for the coming conflagration. And that's just a horribly pessimistic mentality in a country where democracy depends on us having faith in each other and having some sense of psychic security. And so that deep, deep pessimism is, I'm afraid, radicalizing the party in ongoing.
Jonathan, thoughts on that?
Well, I read David's column and I thought it was terrific, and it is a sobering warning for the rest of the country. What has happened to the Republican Party, it's terrible for governance, but it's also terrible for the direction that the country is going in, especially a country that is changing demographically as quickly as the United States. We are not going to be able to hold the enterprise that is America together as long as one of the two major parties in this country, one, doesn't govern, and two, gives voice to and gives cover for domestic terrorists, racism, and the perpetuation of white supremacy. We will not survive if that is the way the Republican Party will remain.
Sobering ending to this conversation. David, we thank you. And Jonathan, we thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you too, Judy.
As we do at the end of every week, we remember some of the remarkable individuals who've lost their lives to COVID-19. Aaron Aheney had a deep belly laugh and a natural charm, traits that made him a great friend and a gifted salesman, his family said. Brooklyn bred, he served in the Korean War as a combat medic. Days before shipping off, he married, starting a 69-year partnership. After years in sales, he opened a wholesale bakery business with his son, best known for their take on the iconic New York black and white cookie.
This is a New York product. It's a way of life in New York.
Even at 89 years old, Aaron was an avid baseball fan who loved cheering on the Yankees with his kids and grandkids and cracking the bat on his neighborhood team. Heather Williams was usually the loudest mom cheering on the sidelines for her children's sports games. Born in Oklahoma, she settled with her husband in Houston, Texas. The couple, both college athletes, loved sports, whether they were watching the Texas Longhorns or Little League. Heather was deeply compassionate and caring, her husband said, not only as a wife, mother, and friend, but also as a teacher. The 42-year-old taught children of all ages, from elementary to high school, in person and virtually throughout the pandemic. Jordan Tassi was the social glue among his friends, who said he was outgoing, hilarious, and deeply loyal to those he loved. At high school in Montclair, New Jersey, a school project led Jordan to discover an interest in and talent for photography. When he graduated, Jordan, known to friends as Polo, launched a film business called Polo Films, where he directed and shot music videos and performances for aspiring artists. Jordan was 22 years old. Teresa Twist was told to drop out of high school when she couldn't read the chalkboard and soon after was declared legally blind. She left and became a mother, but she never lost her drive to get educated. Decades later, she completed her degree. From there on, Teresa dedicated herself to helping other children with disabilities as a teacher's aide in Ocala, Florida. Fun and bubbly, the 62-year-old wife and mother was easy to befriend, striking a special bond with her oldest granddaughter. Coach Damian Jackson never raised his voice off the field. A former high school football and track star, Damian returned to his alma mater in Columbia, South Carolina, as a math teacher, offensive coordinator, and girls' track and field coach. In every role, he was calm and steady, a great listener, and a sounding board for anyone in need, his wife said. After a long friendship and courtship, the pair tied the knot and had two children of their own. Damian was 42 years old. And we thank family members for sharing these stories with us. Our hearts go out to you, as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic. It turns out being the biggest and the richest does not always mean you win. As Amna Nawaz tells us, this week, football fans united globally to block a secret super soccer league.
Judy, imagine in pro baseball that the Yankees, the Red Sox, and the Cubs broke away with other profitable teams to set up their own league. That is what these European soccer clubs were trying to do. And their failure is a stunning 180 for some powerful team owners who aren't used to the word no. Just days after the so-called Super League was unveiled, the architects of the scheme scuttled their plans and apologized, facing enraged fans and governments. For more on exactly what happened and why it matters, even outside the soccer world, we're joined by Roger Bennett. He is the co-host of the Men in Blazers TV show and the author of the upcoming book, Reborn in the USA, An Englishman's Love Letter to His Adopted Home. Roger Bennett, welcome back to the NewsHour, and help us understand how in the span of 5 days we went from Super League to Super Fail. What exactly happened?
It's been a historic, shocking, remarkable week for global football. It all began Sunday night when 12 of the biggest teams in Europe announced they'd signed off in secret to a breakaway pan-European league, the Super League, backed by JP Morgan, in which the six richest teams in England would join three each from Italy and Spain, and they'd play each other on an annual basis. A bit like, as you say, if Duke, North Carolina, and Kansas announced a breakaway from March Madness, in which they were guaranteed participation every single year. This would have transformed the complex European footballing pyramid, which has taken 140 years to build up, and turn it really into a WrestleMania-style, profit-maximizing blockbuster event. And you had oligarchs, European industrialists, and four American sports investors making an Augustus Gloop-level power grab. And astonishingly, it felt unstoppable Sunday night, but on Tuesday, it had all fallen apart.
And how did it fall apart? When it came to the opposition, where was the loudest, most vociferous opposition coming from to this?
It did do something remarkable for a moment, the Super League. It united fans, it united players, it united James Corden, even the royal family weighed in. And it turned out to be a rollout, which really was a sporting version of New Coke, a massive money plan put together by billionaires who hired cross-continental PR specialists, lobbyists, whole troll farms. And of all the scenarios that they thought about, and they really did plan for this, the possibility of their own fans turning on them clearly never crossed their minds. They thought the only challenges would come from supporters of the lesser clubs that they'd left behind in the dust, which proved to be a historic misread, perhaps the biggest in global football club history. Because above all, English football fans are tribal. They are passionate. The clubs are so deeply rooted in the community, such an expression of the fans' identity. They're not afterthoughts. The fans are not customers. The teams are not franchises. And the American owners who drove the Premier League plan in England didn't realise just how much their own fans cared. They didn't really understand the heart of football. And in not recognising that, they stuck a dagger straight into that heart.
You mentioned some of those American owners. There are familiar names for folks in our audience, right? John Henry, who owns Liverpool Football Club, also owns the Boston Red Sox, the Glazer family, who own Manchester United, also own the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I think it baffles people that they misread the fans so deeply. Help us understand, is there a sports culture divide there that the American and foreign owners just didn't get what was going on the ground?
It is truly remarkable to me that they own something that is so wildly popular and that they have no sense of exactly what they own. One of the American owners, Stan Kroenke of the LA Rams, owns Arsenal Football Club. They are playing as we speak. Their fans, over 1,000 of them, surrounded the stadium. Football's currently in a fanless state and demanded that he sell up immediately. It's like a scene from Les Mis. Do you hear the people singing the song of angry men? But it's not so simple. There's not that many individuals who have $3 billion lying around who can replace these gentlemen. And that is now the ensuing battle. What now for these Premier League teams?
So what now then, Raj? What happens now? Not just for the sport, but for the business. It's been growing rapidly across Asia, certainly here in the U.S. with all this plotting and scheming and these leaders being called traitors. How does this move forward?
Well, on Tuesday, when one of the teams, Manchester City, pulled out of their plans to join the Super League, UEFA, the governing body in Europe, issued a statement welcoming Manchester City back into the European family, which was predictable, but still incredibly shocking, because 24 hours earlier, Manchester City were turncoats, defectors, trying to destroy everything. But they will be welcomed back. There's so much money at stake. And while this Super League mistake has stained the reputation of many in a way that won't be forgotten, the American owners have already started to undertake their versions of apology tours. Josh Kroenke apologised to Arsenal fans. That predictably didn't go well. And Liverpool's John Henry, the Boston Red Sox owner, released a video in which he apologised, accepted full blame. And it was kind of as effective as Fredo Corleone apologising for betraying the family. A fan outside of Arsenal's stadium this afternoon held up a sign saying, "Fans won, billionaires zero." But for now, it's important to recognise the bodies of football, UEFA, FIFA, remain more corrupt than Tammany Hall. Racism still stains the game. There's going to be a World Cup in Qatar. So there'll be a lot of talk about reform. But this is just one war that's been won, like the battle for Endor. And there are many battles to come.
So a Star Wars reference, a Godfather reference, and Les Mis, all wrapped up into one. We can't ask for much more from you. That's Roger Bennett, co-host of the Men in Blazers show. Raj, always good to see you. Come back soon.
Amnar, send my love to Judy Woodruff. Courage.
Thank you, Amna. We love any Godfather reference, and we need more Roger Bennett on the NewsHour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here on Monday evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe and have a good weekend.